The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
This is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. I'm so glad you are back. What a day of contrasts. As we are sitting here on Tuesday, we had a bit of a split screen, or split reality, in essence. On one hand, President Biden went to the Capitol, and he gave an impassioned speech on anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. And what he was saying is, no matter what form it takes, no matter who is making the comments, no matter who is engaged in the activity, we do not tolerate anti-Semitism. We do not tolerate hate. We don't tolerate violence. We're a country of laws. We're a country of inclusion. And whatever argument you have, whatever point you want to make, you make it peacefully, you make it respectfully, and you do not harass, threaten, intimidate American Jews. It was a robust statement. It was high-minded. It could not have been more timely during a period of time where we've just come through campus after campus being occupied, not by people who simply want the Palestinian people to be protected, but people who are calling the October 7 terrorists martyrs, people who are echoing the Hamas party line. And I think Biden gave the speech he needed to. It was emotional. It was reassuring for those of us who thought we were losing our minds. We're not. And he said as much. So that was one side of the screen. On the other side of the screen, and unfortunately, you only hear people talking about it because it's not really on the screen. Donald Trump's New York trial is not being televised. But nevertheless, you could have coverage of the latest from the New York business records falsification case. And who was on the stand today but Stormy Daniels? And I have to say, for those of you who thought this is just a minor case, or who cares about this case, or we don't need this case, or why are we having this case, I hope your mind has been changed over the weeks. Because especially today, but throughout this process, we have gotten a unmistakable picture of Donald Trump as a sleazy, lying, really bullying, unpleasant character, and someone entirely unworthy, forgetting about the presidency, holding any office, holding any position of responsibility. And when Stormy Daniels gets up there to testify as to the, I hate to even say affair, but the encounter she had with Donald Trump, you get a sense of just how grimy his life is. And why is this relevant? Why is this important? Because he knows it's grimy. He knows it's disgusting. And so when it came to the presidential election, and when he feared after the Access Hollywood tape was surfaced that more stories would come out from Stormy Daniels, from others, he panicked. He was desperate to shut up these women. And I have to say, had he just given them stacks of cash, or had he given them a check directly, recorded it accurately, reported them to the FEC as part of his campaign expenses, he wouldn't be sitting in a courtroom. But because he concealed it, because he lied, because he mischaracterized what those payments are, he arguably committed a crime in the state of New York. And that's what he's on trial for. But the reason that he could not bring himself to level with the American people goes back to a fundamental split in Donald Trump's brain between the image he projects as tough, as morally superior, as the defender of America, as the only guy standing between you and chaos, the downfall of Western civilization, and the reality, which is a steamy, sleazy operator who is so cheap and so dishonest that after he won the election, he was considering not paying these people. That's right. Once the election was won and he no longer had to worry about another woman stepping forward, he asked his cronies, do we really have to pay these women? Yes, you have to pay these women. So that's what the election is about. But what we're also seeing throughout is that Donald Trump cannot physically, mentally, emotionally control himself. That's why he's been cited for contempt 10 times. That's why he's probably going to get cited at some point again. And if we believe Justice Merchan, which we should, he may get to see the inside of a cell before the trial is out. Now, I wouldn't get your hopes up. He's not going to Rikers Island, and he's probably not going there for more than a day, maybe even just be a few hours. But that's how incapable he is of submitting to the rules. He refuses to recognize the power of the courts, the power of the law, because no one tells Donald Trump what to do. But in fact, they do. And that's why he's incurring the wrath of the judge. That's why he is forcing his lawyer to make ridiculous arguments, why he's forcing his lawyers to cross-examine witnesses ad nauseum when it serves no good purpose for him. He is, I think, having a mental, emotional explosion in his brain. And so should we be surprised that he's now gotten the moniker of Sleepy Don or Snorkoleone? No. And that's because, number one, he's not in good health, mentally, physically, emotionally, but also because he cannot stand being there. He cannot face reality. And the reality is this trial is not going well for him. The witnesses are overperforming. Hope Hicks was a devastating, believable witness who ties Donald Trump to the hush money, who makes it clear that it was for the purpose of making sure he got elected president of the United States. We've seen witness after witness who works for Donald Trump, some of them still work for Donald Trump, attesting to the scheme, attesting to the falsification of records. And for those people who doubted that Alvin Bragg had a strong case, I hope they're reconsidering, because we have seen an extremely strong case. It's solid on the law, it's solid on the facts. Now, the big question mark that remains is what kind of witness is Michael Cohen going to be? What the prosecutors have done is set up a web, a forest of evidence that is going to corroborate most of what Michael Cohen will testify to. So that if you don't believe Michael Cohen on a certain point, there's lots of other evidence. But Michael Cohen is still an important witness. He's got to testify that Donald Trump was intimately involved, excuse the expression, intimately, with the decision to phony up payments to make it look like he was getting billed for legal services, when in fact this was nothing but a disguised payment to shut up women. That's why Michael Cohen is important. Now, his testimony may be relatively brief if the prosecutor is smart. Get him in, get him out. And the prosecution is well aware that Donald Trump is going to insist on his lawyers beating up this guy, keeping him on the stand, harassing him, going through all of his failures, which we all know. He did plead guilty. He has served time in jail. He has lied. But I think what we're getting from the Donald Trump saga is, what do you expect? This guy did not hang out with Pulitzer Prize winners and humanitarians. He hung out with other sleazy people, because those are the kind of people who go and work for Donald Trump. So in essence, part of what we are learning is that Donald Trump, who of course demands loyalty from everyone, has to surround himself with a bunch of lowlife. And if you don't like Michael Cohen, if you think he's sleazy, if you think these women have exploited the situation, whatever you think, that's who Donald Trump hangs with. And is that really the person we want to be president of the United States? For some of these people, yes, because they don't believe anything. They don't believe the witnesses. They don't believe the documents. They don't believe the news. They're living in dreamland because it is so important for them to remember that he is their end-all and be-all. He is the only source of truth. He is what's standing between them and the downfall of civilization. So they're unreachable. But I got to think that there are millions of Americans who still care, who still don't want this sleazy guy in the White House, and who understand how emotionally, intellectually unfit he really is. And for that reason, this trial is really, really important. And I have to say, the media is doing a halfway good job of covering it. Not every article, not every outlet, but they really are explaining the strength of the case, and they're explaining the evidence that we have seen. So try to follow if you like, but at least follow the great legal commentators who are out there. We are blessed with a phalanx of lawyers who communicate intelligently in plain language and can make this perfectly understandable. And encourage your friends, even those who are feigning ignorance, to catch a little bit of the coverage, because it's an education. And it's an education about what Donald Trump fears most of all, and that is the rule of law. There's a certain beauty to the system that Donald Trump has to sit there, that he's going to get treated, by and large, maybe with a few allowances, like any criminal defendant, and he's going to have to wait for 12 men and women to decide whether he is convicted or not. That's powerful. And that's something to be optimistic about. So remember, we are in for the fight of our lives. Democracy is on the line. The rule of law is on the line. But you can make it happen. You can vote. You can get your friends and relations to vote. You can donate time. You can donate money. Because the fate of democracy rests not only with those 12 people in a courtroom, but with each of you.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
It seems like we are wallowing in trials. Donald Trump appears every day now in a New York courtroom. His lawyers continue to make all sorts of claims up and down the federal courts and in state courts. Plus, we have to look forward to, or to dread, depending upon your position, the upcoming elections, when Republicans once again are going to be conspiring, there's no other word for it, to deprive African Americans, poor people, people who have an hourly job, of the opportunity to vote. They're installing hacks in positions of importance for vote counting. They are stripping states of the ability to offer convenient in-mail and absentee ballots. So what do we do about it? Well, we've got the perfect person. We've got Mark Elias, who is the bane of Republicans' voter suppression existence. He continues to litigate in every state, up and down the federal courts, up and down the state courts. He is the guru of all things voter-related, so he's the perfect person to chat with. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, as we see here on Tuesday, Stormy Daniels has been on the stand. I cannot unhear some of that testimony, I must admit. Give me your general impression of how that trial in general is going.
I think it's going quite well for the prosecution and quite badly for Donald Trump and his defense lawyers. You know, being a defense lawyer, and I've tried criminal cases as a defense lawyer, is a very difficult thing when your client is behaving under the best of circumstances. I never feel bad for any lawyer who takes on Donald Trump as a client because they knew what they were getting themselves into. But if ever there was an instance where a lawyer's job was made harder by his client, I think it's this instance.
Absolutely. And it's not just the fact that they have to deal with all of the contempt stuff, but he, I think, makes them do things that undermine the case. Some of these cross-examinations should be very brief, in and out, but he plainly wants them to perform. And so they drag things out. They make stupid arguments. But that's, as you say, that is Donald Trump. He's not exactly a strategic legal thinker.
Yeah, Jen, I think you've actually just hit the critical thing about this trial, that for people who have not been paying attention to the trial, or even frankly people who see some of the talking heads on TV, may have missed. As often as not, criminal cases are won and lost on not what you ask the witness, but what you don't ask the witness, right? You hear this sometimes, like, never ask a question that you don't know the answer to, but it goes beyond that. It is, as you say, the demeanor that the lawyer brings on cross-examination to a witness oftentimes influences for the jury whether the jury is to pay a lot of heed and attention to that witness or just kind of shrug their shoulders like, I don't know how they fit in. And Donald Trump clearly is telling his lawyers to treat every witness as if they are the biggest, most critical, harmful witness. Rather than, for some of these, you're right, the defense, you know, one of the things you do as a defense lawyer is you sometimes, for dramatic effect, say, I have no questions.
Exactly. Particularly these so-called custodial witnesses. They're there just to affirm that's the check, that's the signature, and... you know, as you say, they treat this like the end of the world. Switching gears just a little bit, you're a Supreme Court watcher, among the better ones. Do you have a sense of where the Supreme Court is going on the immunity case?
So let me first start by saying that the argument was wild. I mean, for people who don't regularly pay attention to Supreme Court arguments, this was one of the craziest, unhinged performance by the U.S. Supreme Court, which says a lot because they don't usually get like far afield from the law. And there were elements of this argument in which you just heard some of the questions from the conservative justices and you were thinking, what constitutional provision are they hanging this on? What legal theory are they hanging this on? It was just kind of like I described it to someone as kind of like a Federalist Society sociology class at the University of Chicago's Economics School. It was just like justices just kind of like, well, I think this might incentivize this and that. I mean, the one thing the conservative legal establishment has going for it for years has been that it at least, you know, pays lip service to originalism and textualism. Originalism is what did people mean at the time of that the Constitution was written? Textualism be what do the words mean? Here, there is neither an originalist nor a textualist argument available to Trump. But the conservatives didn't seem bothered by that. They just sort of went forward. Now,
right.
Jen, at the end of the day, what do I think happens? I think the three liberals are not gonna go there to the crazy place. I don't think the chief is. I think the chief very much wants to keep this at least in the bounds of, you know, something that won't be viewed as ridiculous. And then the question is whether Comey Barrett comes along. I think Kavanaugh is much, much further in the conservative camp here, along with Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas. So I think Barrett is really probably the swing vote here, although if you put a gun to my head, I'd say the chief will want to write the opinion because he's the chief justice. So look for the chief justice to write a somewhat muddled multi-factor test opinion that he sends back to the trial court.
I think that's very fair. I would quibble with only one thing, and that is these are not conservatives. These are right-wing activist ideologues. I think it was Alito who made the bizarro, backwards, upside-down argument that if you don't provide immunity to presidents, they'll be incentivized to stage coups and stay in office.
Yeah.
Like, what is that all about? That's nutso.
Yeah, and so it's what the audience needs to understand is it's nutso from two perspectives. It's nutso because on its merits, it's nuts. But it's even in some ways as a lawyer, a offensively nuts. Yes. In that that just isn't the job of justices. Like the job of the justices is not to anticipate like what a rational actor president will be incentivized from. The fact is, when the Constitution was written, it contained a type of absolute immunity for legislators. For legislators, the speech and debate clause. So the founders knew how to put immunity in the Constitution if it wanted to. They didn't put it in for presidents. They explicitly didn't put it in for presidents. There's nothing in the text that supports an immunity for presidents. And there's nothing at the founding as an originalist matter that they wanted immunity for presidents in because they had just been done with a king.
Yes.
Like the last thing they wanted to do was go back to executives that had absolute power.
This almost seems like an AP U.S. government problem, and that they're flunking the test and misunderstanding or intentionally distorting where the framers are. It tells you how far down the road they have gone on executive power. And it's interesting what you say about Kavanaugh, and I think this is right. He is as far to the extreme right on executive power.
That's
even
right.
Though he may be more thoughtful or more nuanced on other issues, he is right there. And I think that's because that's where he kind of grew up. He grew up as a hatchet man for, you know, conservatives in power. He was the handyman for, you know, Ken Starr. And that's kind of how he thinks of the government, as it's the president's prerogative, period.
Yeah, which is ironic because, of course, again, if you were an originalist and you look back at the founding, you said, well, Congress, the founders wanted to have Congress be the most powerful branch of government, right? And the executive was not viewed as, it was purposely meant to be in many respects co-equal, but also subordinate to Congress. The power to declare war, the power to tax, were all rested with the most populous, you know, the most popularly elected branches. And, you know, I understand why you might design a government differently, but there is nothing in this government's constitution that provides for immunity.
That's right. And you need not go any further than the number. Article 1 is the Congress.
That's right.
Article 2 would be the executive. So the Supreme Court has a lot of cases that they have to issue before they may go into August. They may go into, well, God forbid August, but they may go into July this year. Which voting cases are you most concerned about, or voting rights cases are you most concerned about that you're watching for in the final weeks, months of the term?
Sure. So obviously we talked about the Trump immunity case, not a voting case, but it's a very core democracy case.
Yes.
The case that I am most curious about and which I am most outraged about as someone who watches the Supreme Court is a racial gerrymandering case out of South Carolina. So South Carolina redrew its maps like everybody else, like all the other states after the census came out in 2021. They redrew Nancy Mace's district. People out there are familiar with Nancy Mace. and Nancy Mace's district had been a very swingy district, and the Republicans wanted to make it a safer district. So what they did is they moved a large number of black voters out of her district and into Jim Clyburn's district neighboring. And they got sued. The three federal court judges agreed that this was a racial gerrymander, that these black voters had been moved for impermissible reasons. And the case goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, you know, set aside whether the U.S. Supreme Court needed to decide to have oral arguments in this case, but they did. Both the state of South Carolina and the plaintiffs, so everyone in the case, told the Supreme Court, we need a decision by January 1st, 2024. Okay, it was one of the earliest argued cases of this term. And they said, please decide this by January 1st. It is now May, and there is still not a decision in this case, which means that black voters are going to vote under illegal, unconstitutional maps again in 2024, regardless of how the Supreme Court rules. And so to me, I'm waiting on this case, A, because it's an important case involving racial gerrymandering, but B, because, you know, if there is supposed to be some measure of comedy between the branches, when the plaintiffs representing the black voters say, we need a decision to not be discriminated against, and the state of South Carolina says, hey, we need a decision because we have to administer elections, for the judicial branch to just sort of shrug its shoulders while it, for example, fast-tracked the Donald Trump 14th Amendment case, you know, it's really something. So I'm waiting to see what that decision is probably the top one.
And we've seen this before. We've seen this movie before. They often come out with the opinion that, well, it's too late now to make the change. There's actually a legal principle that they refer to. So if you just wait long enough and monkey around with the calendar, they can decide that way. And that, yeah, I find to be one of the most offensive aspects of this court. Some people call it the shadow docket. Other people just call it, you know, kind of scheduling. They are using the power of their own schedule to implicitly block claims or accelerate claims. We have heard through the grapevine that they instantaneously wanted to take Dobbs. They just waited a little while after Amy Coney Barrett had joined the court so it wouldn't look so bad. What could be more partisan and more inappropriate than that? I don't remember any court doing this before.
Me neither. And I think you've really put your finger on something, because regardless of how the Supreme Court comes out on the immunity claim, let's assume that they surprise us and they reject the immunity claim. They fast-tracked the 14th Amendment claim to make sure that everyone knew Donald Trump would be on the ballot in Colorado. They literally had a special session in order to hand down that opinion the day before of the Colorado primary. So they fast-tracked that case. They took it quicker. They had it argued quicker. They decided it quicker. This case involving immunity, they didn't have to take it at all, right? They then took it slower, had it argued slower, and as we sit here, we still don't have a decision. So what that means is even if the Donald Trump loses, it makes it practically impossible, if not impossible, for the federal case in D.C. to go forward before the election, which, as you say, is kind of a unique way of using the calendar, right? It's like using their power to calendar cases to effectively decide them. And in South Carolina, that has already happened. The state of South Carolina has said it is too late. And even I, who is a critic of the state of South Carolina and cares a lot about racial gerrymandering, they're kind of right. Like, the Supreme Court has dithered in this case.
Yes.
While primary elections are coming up and the general election, like, it's just inexcusable.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Let's get a little wonky and a little legally nerdy here. The Voting Rights Act, which has partially been invalidated, the pre-authorization portion, which forced states that were frankly guilty of historic discrimination to go to the Justice Department to get these kinds of changes approved in advance, that's been taken away. But as dangerous, or maybe even more so, is what they've done to another portion of the Voting Rights Act, and that is Section 2, which is kind of the bread and butter of voting rights, which gives, we thought, private individuals, the government, the right to challenge these racially gerrymandered districts. What has the court done in that area, and what was the original intention of Section 2?
Yeah. So Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is really, as you say, the bread and butter for most protections of minority voting in this country. There are other provisions, but really the centerpiece of it is Section 2, which allows the Department of Justice or private individuals or voting rights organizations to bring claims against vote dilution and other types of invidious discrimination in voting. And for, you know, for since its passage in 1965, however many years that is, yeah. It has been enforced vigorously by private litigants. So the Department of Justice plays an important role, but because of their limited resources, the overwhelming majority, 80%+ of all of the voting, Section 2 voting rights victories that we have seen in this country have come from private litigants, whether it's the NAACP or it's folks that we represent at my law firm or whomever. Like, it's just you incentivize, you know, the private bar, big law, small law, civil rights groups, you know, ferreting out these violations of voting rights and bringing these cases. All of a sudden, in the last few years, Republicans have, as the Federalist Society has promulgated a series of other frivolous right-wing legal theories to close the court doors. They came up with this theory that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and also another provision called the Civil Rights Act, which actually predated the Voting Rights Act. It was Congress's first effort at this, which contains provisions that, for example, prohibit states from putting immaterial requirements in voting, like counting jelly beans in a jar, right? You can't have requirements for voting that are not material. The conservative legal establishment, or the right-wing legal establishment, to use the right term, thank you, has started to say, well, you know what? We don't think private litigants can bring these claims. Only the Department of Justice can. Now, this has no historical support. This has really no textual support. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided dozens of cases at this point under Section 2 and the Civil Rights Act involving private litigants. No one's ever suggested that there is not a private right of action. But all of a sudden, you know, this started to crop up, and it's the usual thing we see, Jen. First, it was like, you know, in right-wing circles, and people kind of were like, that's ridiculous. Then it kind of gained some currency in the academic press. And now you see Republican state attorney general in state after state after state taking the position that there is no private right of action. I think there are 26 Republican attorneys general in Democracy Docket, the outlet I founded, to track this. 22 of them have now taken the position there's no private right of action. By the way, many of those 22 are not even in lawsuits. They've just filed amicus briefs for the point of pointing out in other states that there's a private right of action. So far, this has been, you know, this has only gained traction in one circuit, the Eighth Circuit, in a case out of Arkansas, found that there's no private right of action. The Fifth Circuit, which is very conservative, which covers Texas and Alabama and Mississippi, said there is a private right of action. But these attacks continue. And, you know, for those people who think that, for example, Brad Raffensperger is a hero of the voting rights story, you know, right now, one of the leading cases advancing this is in the 11th Circuit, where the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, is claiming that in two redistricting cases he lost there, that there is no private right of action. So this continues. Obviously, they are hoping for a circuit split and to get this up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where we will have to try to see if we can cobble together five votes to protect Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
And this is not really an esoteric issue. The Justice Department on its own can't possibly litigate all cases, find all plaintiffs, do all of the legwork. And that's why the statute exists. Because, as you say, you need to incentivize big law, little law, groups like the NAACP to enforce the law. So what they're really saying is, we want to starve the litigants, the plaintiffs, of opportunities to litigate unconstitutional, illegal voting suppression, because we want to take away everybody but the Justice Department from the bar that fights these things. And that is, again, it's so backhanded. If they don't like the Voting Rights Act, try to repeal it. I mean, they've done a bang-up job getting rid of Section 5. Just have the nerve to do it. Don't lie that it wasn't intended as a private right of action.
Yeah, and it will have a devastating effect on the real lives of real people. You know, sometimes we think about this as like a fight among lawyers about doctrines, but, you know, right now in the state of Alabama, black voters have in the past two elections voted in illegal districts, okay? a federal court, three-judge panel, including two Donald Trump appointees, found that the districts that they voted in violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. My law firm was one of the law firms that was the lead plaintiff and represented one of the two lead sets of plaintiffs that brought that case. That case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed that there was a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. As a result, Alabama has a new map for 2024, and it contains an additional Black Opportunity District. And so for the first time in many years, Black voters in Alabama will have the opportunity to vote in legal districts that do not discriminate against them. The real-world effect of taking away Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is that those voters will now be discriminated against. In Louisiana, where there was a Section 2 case that my law firm brought and won, those voters would be discriminated against. In Georgia, where Brad Rassenberger is appealing these cases, both state legislative and congressional districts are struck down under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as discriminating against Black voters. These are real-world consequences. These Black voters or other minorities around the country should not have to suffer the indignity of having their states pass laws that discriminate against them by on purpose in many instances, and not have the ability to remedy those unless you are able to tap into the very limited resources that the Department of Justice has.
Now, you litigate in probably all 50 states at one time or another, maybe not 50 all at once, but I think you've litigated, it's fair to say, in 50 states, maybe even
yes,
the District
of Columbia. I've litigated in every state.
All right. So these things, as we've pointed out, go in trends. There are the efforts to suppress Black voting. There are the efforts to prohibit absentee or voting by mail. What seems to be the latest trend that Republicans are pursuing in their effort to carve up the electorate so that it looks more like them and less like America?
Yeah. So to understand the answer to that question, you have to start with the following, which is that Republicans are not going to compete to win a majority of the electorate in 2024. One of the big misnomers that you sometimes hear in the media is they'll say, Donald Trump, won a majority in 2016. He didn't. He lost the majority of the electoral of the popular vote. He won the Electoral College. He lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. In 2020, he lost it by 7 million votes. So let's just spot 10 million, based on trend. They know that they will lose the popular vote by between 7 and 10 million votes. At some point, they run out of runway. Right. At some point, you can't even count on the Electoral College to keep you in the game if you are ever losing by larger and larger popular vote margins. So what are you left to do? You have two choices. You either make it harder to vote or easier to cheat. So the harder to vote part is you pass voter suppression laws that target Black, brown, and young voters principally, but other populations as well, to either geographically or demographically, to make it harder for example, voters in Philadelphia to vote, right? Because you don't want voters in Philadelphia to vote. Now, you may target them geographically by targeting cities. You may target them demographically by targeting, for example, Black voters that disproportionately are in Philadelphia relative to the rest of the state. So we see voter suppression laws in state after state after state that basically target people who live in cities and racial minorities. Okay, so why do you pass a law, for example, that says you can only have one ballot drop box per county? Well, because if you're in a very populous county, that literally makes no sense.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense anyway, but it particularly doesn't make any sense there. The second thing you do, though, is that you make it easier to cheat. Now, sometimes I get a lot of pushback on this, but I ask them, what do you think Donald Trump did after 2020? Right? What do you think these people, the fake elector scheme was, right? It was an effort to cheat. What do you think the insurrection in the nation's capital was? It was an effort to cheat. And so a lot of the laws and the litigation we are seeing, and the RNC is bringing a lot more litigation than they ever have before, and they have been open that they are coordinating with right-wing grassroots vigilante organizations. What they are trying to do is to set the stage that we will have more voter intimidation at the polls, we will have more intimidation of election officials, and we will have more opportunities to uncount ballots or to throw away ballots. When Donald Trump says stop the count, that is an effort to cheat. And when Laura Trump goes on TV recently and says we're trying to pass a law in Nevada that doesn't allow ballots to be counted after Election Day, What she's really saying is we want to throw out ballots that haven't yet been counted.
Right? Yes.
And so that's just a way of cheating. And we're seeing more and more of that. So I want to, Jen, I want to give you one concrete example that your audience should be aware of. There are three lawsuits that have been filed in the last 2 months by Republicans claiming that they have a First Amendment right to harass election officials. Literally, that's it. I'm not like, you can literally look them up. They are laws that say you cannot harass or dox or intimidate election workers. And they are challenging them in Nevada, Arizona, and Minnesota under a First Amendment theory that they have the right to harass, intimidate, and dox election officials.
That's crazy. That is crazy stuff.
Right.
And it's not like they haven't tried it before. I distinctly remember, because we talked about it at the time, that in Arizona, they had armed vigilantes hanging around a drop box in Arizona. And they were defending that, the right to hang around with guns at an election spot. This is like pre-Reconstruction kind of tactics. They're not embarrassed about this. They're just out in the open trying to intimidate people and keep them from the polls.
That's right. And what happened is Arizona then passed regulations to prohibit that. Nevada passed a law called the Election Workers Protection Act. Minnesota passed a similar law. And they are challenging those. They are saying, like, you cannot ban us from videotaping election officials going to their cars, intimidating them, staking out drop boxes, you know, in armed body armor and the like. You can't do any of that because we have a First Amendment right. And it's not just wrong on the law. It is a warning sign to all of the rest of us that they are not doing this in quiet. They are doing this in the broad daylight. They are saying we are going to do these things.
Yes.
And so those of us who believe in democracy, we are either going to prepare ourselves for this or we are going to say, oh, they'll never do that. Oh, that's just Donald Trump talking. It's not just Donald Trump talking. This is what they're planning.
And we have to remember, there are legal means, because we see it all the time, of challenging elections. There are a zillion ways through up and down through the state bureaucracies, through the state courts, through the federal courts. If you think the election has not been run fairly, you get a zillion bites of the apple. This is not one of those areas of laws where it's really, really, really hard to kind of mount a challenge. And in fact, one of the other areas that I know Republicans have been pushing is to make it easier to bring all kinds of frivolous challenges. So they are empowering individuals to go around challenging other people's votes based on simply a suspicion or an accusation that perhaps a signature doesn't match one that was taken 20 years ago when you registered to vote and one which comes in.
It's much worse than that, Jen. There are right-wing vigilante efforts right now using big data, using AI. These are not my words. These are the words of the people who are doing this, well-funded organizations that are getting voter files from every state or as many states they can, which means they are getting, Jen, your name, your address, your party affiliation, your vote history, all right? They're getting all kinds of personal information about you, and they are then taking this data. They are appending to it all kinds of other data, like, you know, change of address records, maybe Zillow records. They'll see whether you put an Airbnb ad up. Who knows? Who knows what they're appending to it, right? And they then spit out lists of thousands and thousands and thousands of names that right-wing vigilantes then take and walk down to their local election officials and say, we don't think these people should be allowed to vote. Okay. In Georgia, in 2021, 361,000 Georgians had their right to vote challenged. In the 2022 election, another 100,000 Georgians were challenged. And what winds up happening is if you're a voter, you wind up in this administrative process of where you're told you may be illegal, you may not be allowed to vote and the like. And, you know, a few things happen. Number one, some legal voters get removed from the rolls, and we just saw that in Michigan. Actually, I think a veteran or a member of the military got removed, right? Because these efforts are riddled with errors about why people should be removed. Number one, but number two, people, you are dissuading, you are intimidating people from participating in the process. You know, I use this analogy with some trepidation because obviously there are lots of opinions that different people have about what's going on college campuses. But just imagine you're on a college campus and there is a big conflagration and people are in tents and they're banging pots and they're chanting and they're yelling on which side or the other. And you're a student, you're like, you know what, who needs the trouble? I'll just walk a different way. Yeah. Right, I won't walk that way. I'll walk this path. Well, that's what the Republicans are hoping to do with these voter intimidation tactics. Is they're like, you know what? There's a guy at the drop box with a gun, buddy over.
Who I'm not needs going to,
like, how much is my vote really that important? You know, I'm being challenged in my right to vote. I don't need the trouble. I don't need the hassle. I don't need to put myself in controversy.
Yes, and then you have states like Florida, where they have essentially assembled a militia on to go after individual voters,
That's
which
right.
overwhelmingly happen to be African-American, to challenge these people, to arrest people who they think are voting, quote, illegally. Talk to us a little bit about that, an entire police force dedicated to, in essence, voter suppression.
Yeah, look, this is, I think, if Donald Trump wins, one of the things we're going to see is which we see in other countries with authoritarian regimes, is we're going to see the melding of state police and sort of private militia and, you know, sort of gang-related enforcement, right? So we're just talking about this spectrum, right? At one end of the spectrum, you have the right-wing activist who maybe even it means well. They've been lied to for so many times. They're told that there are illegal people voting, and they sign up, and they get a list of people, and they submit it for challenge. Okay, then a few gradations from there, you have the people in the body armor, right? Still not state-sponsored, right? But they are now, they view themselves as part of some larger, you know, quasi-militia, you know, militia-like effort, right? We're still just starting to see the sovereign citizens movement to get into the voting rights space. But then, you're exactly right, Jen, you have the co-opting of the state in states like, of state power in states like Florida, where they create special police forces that are really at the whims of partisan actors, you know, Ron DeSantis and his ilk, to essentially use the power of the state, the badge and the gun, to intimidate people from voting, to intimidate them through investigations, through, you know, arrests that then get dropped, right? And so I want people to understand that if Donald Trump regains power, it is all of those things. You see this in authoritarian states. You know, they'll say, well, you know, in Iran, this group is very loyal to the regime. And so they are like the top dogs in the Iranian regime. And then further down, you have like the people who are like state-sponsored militias, right? And I'm just telling you, like, you are seeing this gradation on the right in this country, which is why you have Donald Trump as far back as 2020 saying about the Proud Boys, you know, stand back and stand by, right? You saw this interplay in some of the January 6th activity.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
On the other side of the ledger, what are, other than fighting these efforts, what are or what should Democrats be doing in order to make sure that voting is reasonably accessible and that their votes get counted accurately?
Yeah. So look, I think it is incumbent upon every Democrat, and for that matter, every Republican, you know, if there are right-thinking Republicans, it is incumbent on every Democrat and Republican in a position of power, whether it's at the county level, the local level, or the state level, to do everything they can to ensure that every eligible citizen can vote and have their vote counted and counted accurately. And so We cannot excuse anyone from that. If you are in a position of power, whether you are a governor or a legislator or a state council, city council member, you need to ask yourself every day, what can I do to advance the cause of voting and democracy? And it's not enough to say what you did last year or last session. You know, what more can you do now? Because the Republicans are always iterating towards the bad. And so we always need to be iterating towards the good. That's the first thing. The second is that for those people who have been granted the privilege of having a law license, it is incumbent upon all the lawyers out there right now to do everything you can to ensure that voting is available to all. And for some people, that's going to be litigating. For some people, it will be volunteering around the polls. But lawyers need to step up here. In the same way that we saw so many conservative lawyers do the wrong thing around January 6th, we need to see right-thinking lawyers, including right-thinking Republican lawyers, step forward and be like, you know what, I am going to be part of the brigade that is going to protect democracy. That is, I think, a big part of this. Like I said, some will be litigators. My team and I, we are in 50-plus cases in 25 states. So we litigate a lot. But for folks who can't dedicate that many resources, they can be a part of this. And then finally, for every citizen, here is the thing. This is not necessarily the fight that you would have chosen. You know, I realize that for many of you, you wish the fight of this generation was a fight over climate or a fight over immigration, and those are really important. But we're not going to solve any of those problems unless we protect democracy. So the fight of this generation is the fight for democracy. Your children and your grandchildren will ask, what did you do at this time in our nation's history when democracy was at stake? Did you lean into it or did you lean away from it? So we need every citizen to stand up in their town square, right? Not everyone writes for the Washington Post. Not everyone has a podcast like you do, but everyone's got a town square. It may be their dinner table. It may be their local coffee shop. And in that town square, they need to stand up for democracy. They cannot shirk away from having the difficult conversation. You cannot avoid the people who want to suppress the vote. You need to confront them safely, rhetorically, but you need to make it clear that in your community, it is not okay to disenfranchise voters. It is not okay to undermine free and fair elections. And by doing that, by creating an environment of safety, a safe place that everyone feels like, well, if they stood up, I can stand up for voting. I think we'll get through this.
Oh, I hope you are right. Now, there are reasons to be optimistic, or there are rays of optimism out there. One is that when you and others made a big deal of exposing who the election deniers were, who were on the ballot in 2022, who were running for offices that controlled elections, the people, at least in swing states, lost. The Kerry Lakes lost. The gubernatorial candidates, the secretaries of state, the attorneys general, who were in swing states. I'm not talking about red states, which frankly did elect a lot of these people, but they lost. And I think what scares Republicans is that once voters get the idea that the name of the game is stopping you from voting, that becomes a powerful incentive mm-hmm. for people. So I think we need to, and I certainly hope there are people out there who are going to do the same thing this time. We have to shine a light. Who are the people who are denying that Donald Trump lost last time? Who are the people who in advance are saying they will not certify the election? You have a United States Senator, Tim Scott, who is struggling, vying in the beauty contest to become, oh great, to become Donald Trump's vice president, to have the honor of, you know, the mob going after him when he doesn't do the bidding as Mike Pence did, saying he cannot commit to certifying a lawful election. When we hear that, that's, I think, where we have to put up the Klieg lights and, you know, ring the alarm bell. And we got lots of members of Congress who are saying that now on the Republican side, and lots of people in other states. I mean, this is historically shocking to me.
Yeah, and I think your Tim Scott example that you used is really, really instructive, because Tim Scott's the kind of Republican that, frankly, the national media and many people hold up as actually a reasonable Republican around a lot of issues. And yet there he was, as you say, on national television being offered opportunity after opportunity to say that, like, we will respect the results of a free and fair election, and he wouldn't go there. And I think that it is really not well understood among the American public just how much the Overton window has shifted on what is acceptable and not acceptable for a Republican to say. I mean, you know, some of the stuff you see Republicans saying now would have just been thought of as inconceivable in 2020. I don't even mean in, you know, before that. I'm just saying in 2020, if you had had Republicans saying, I don't know whether we will support the outcome of the election, a U.S. senator would have been a dominant news thing. You know, Donald Trump, the interview that he gave in which he basically said, I'm not, tell me what the outcome is and then I'll tell you whether or not I'll abide by the election. The defense of the people who were convicted on January 6th. I mean, the Republican Party's presidential nominee holds rallies in which he calls the people convicted by the Department of Justice for felonies against the United States. He calls them hostages. And now you see members of the House and Senate, Republican members of the House and Senate, using that same language, calling somehow people in our criminal justice system hostages. And it's just become totally normalized. So there is a lot to worry about in that as we get closer to the election, there seems to be two groups of Americans, people who become more outraged by it because they won't let it be normalized, and people who are just either exhausted by it or want it to be normalized and just, you know, kind of say, well, that's just Donald Trump, that's just the Republican Party, and that's not okay. That is not normal. This is not the way a democracy can function.
Well, Mark, as you know, this is ground zero for outrage. And thanks to your work and the work of others, we are still fighting the good fight, I think. Let people know about Democracy Docket, where they can keep track of this stuff, where they can follow this stuff. Where do they find really a wealth of information?
Sure. So look, I started Democracy Docket in 2020 to be a website that provides news, commentary, and opinion about issues related to voting and democracy. And at its core, it has a database of more than 700 cases. They're not cases I'm all involved in. It's cases brought by Republicans, cases brought by other organizations. But it's basically a database of all of the court pleadings organized in a very user-friendly way of voting and election-related cases. So, you know, I say if I say that, you know, Donald Trump lost the case and you're a MAGA Republican listening to this, you don't have to take my word for it. You don't have to take Jen's word for it. You can literally go to Democracy. I can click on it and you can read the court pleadings. It also provides news updates. It has a daily newsletter that provides updates. It has a weekly newsletter, all of which is free. So I hope people take advantage of it.
Absolutely. It is a great resource. And I would say journalists would benefit from using it more frequently because they would stop misreporting and they would certainly get the clue that we're not talking about two ordinary Democratic parties here. We're talking about one party that, for all its flaws, problems, imperfections, still believes people should vote and we should abide by those votes. And we have another party that doesn't think that, that thinks violence is okay, that thinks you win by any means necessary. And that's a stark choice that Americans should be clear-eyed about, shouldn't brush over, shouldn't try to minimize. That's really what we're facing.
Yeah. And, this may sound like an odd thing coming from someone who has spent their career representing voters, but also representing Democrats. I have represented the Democratic Party in one form or another since the early 1990s. And there was nothing that would make me happier than to have a competitive two-party system again,
exactly,
in which the two parties were disagreeing over trade policy. They were disagreeing over healthcare policy. You know, should there be a single payer option? Shouldn't there be? Should Obamacare pass? Like, there's nothing that would give me more pleasure at this point than actually, oddly enough, to see a revitalized Republican Party that could compete on ideas within a framework of democracy. It is very scary as a citizen that we don't have that, because it can't be that you only can have elections that one party wins or else you lose democracy. And yet that is how it feels right now.
every election seems like the perils of Pauline, that were really at a hairbreadth away from destruction, which unfortunately we may be. Mark, thank you. You had the distinction of being the first, I hope not the only, but the first repeat guest on this podcast. And that's because what you're talking about and what you offer is absolutely essential, because you're right. If we lose democracy, we lose everything else. So thank you for all you do. Thank you for coming on the show. And we will put a link in the show notes so that people can reach Democracy Docket.
Thank you very much.
And that was Mark Elias. Wow. It's daunting, really. The degree of sophistication, the money, the reach that Republicans have in trying to, frankly, rig the elections. But we should take solace on a couple counts. First, we have people like Mark who are out litigating. And frankly, his success rate should give us some optimism. When courts are presented with these cases, Mark wins the overwhelming majority of them. And that's because despite the Trump appointees, despite a lot of judges whose judgment we really have to question, the vast majority of judges up and down the court system understand that the right to vote is precious. And they're not going to let Republicans monkey around. They're not going to let Republicans deter people from voting. The notion that they're making elections harder is bad enough, but that they are intimidating people who actually show up to vote is really still shocking in the year 2024. So Mark's out there litigating, but it is also the case that it's really an all hands on deck moment. You have to go volunteer to work as a poll worker. You have to get out and vote. You have to encourage your friends and relations to go out and vote. So these efforts can be overcome. It's not easy. It doesn't make it constitutional that we can muster the energy and the expertise to overcome them. But it does say that I think ultimately they'll be unsuccessful. And what we've seen in 2018, 2020, 2022, 2023 is that the system is more resilient than Republicans think. And Democrats are more motivated than Republicans think. So that should give us all hope for 2024. And boy, is it more important than ever that we make sure Donald Trump gets nowhere near the Oval Office. So if you like the show and you think your friends would like it, please tell them. They can follow us on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.